of litigation, unpaid debts, and criminal convictions, if any. For most of them, I have photographs of their homes or apartments. Picking the right ones will be tricky. Carved in stone is the belief that you want all the black jurors you can get in a criminal trial, because blacks have more sympathy for the accused and a greater distrust of the police and prosecutors. Not so today. The victim, Sean King, was a nice young black man with a good job, a wife, and three clean-cut kids. For a few bucks on the side, he refereed boxing matches and cage fights. When Fabineau finally gets around to the matters at hand, she asks how many in the pool are familiar with the facts surrounding the death of Sean King. Out of the 92, about a quarter of the hands go up, an enormous percentage. She asks them all to stand so we can jot down their names. I glance at Mancini and shake my head. Such a response is unheard of and, in my opinion, clear proof that the trial should be moved. But Mancini just keeps smiling. I write down 22 names. To prevent further contamination, Judge Fabineau decides to take each of the 22 and quiz them individually. We return to her chambers and gather around the same table. Juror number 3 is brought in. Her name is Liza Parnell, and she sells tickets for a regional airline. Married, 2 kids, age 34, husband sells cement. Mancini and I are all charm as we attempt to curry favor with this potential juror. Her Honor takes charge and starts questioning. Neither Liza nor her husband is an MMA fan. In fact, she calls the sport disgusting. But she remembers the riot. It was all over the news, and she saw the video of Tadeo pounding away. She and her husband discussed the incident. They even prayed at church for the recovery of Sean King and were saddened by his death. She would have a difficult time keeping an open mind. The more she is quizzed, the more she realizes how firmly she believes Tadeo is guilty.
"He killed him," she says.
Mancini asks a few of the same questions. I take my turn but do not waste time. Liza will get the boot soon enough. For now, though, she is instructed to return to her seat on row 1 and not say a word. Juror number 11 is the mother of 2 teenage boys, both of whom love cage fighting and have spent hours discussing Tadeo and Sean King. She hasn't watched the video, though her boys begged her to. She does, however, know all about the case and admits to having plenty of preconceived notions. Mancini and I politely poke and prod but get nothing. She too will be excused. The afternoon grinds on as we work through the 22 jurors, all of whom, it turns out, know far more than they should. A couple claim they can set aside their initial opinions and decide the case with open minds. I doubt this, but then I am the defense lawyer. Late in the day, after we have finished with the 22, I renew my motion for a change of venue. Armed with fresh and irrefutable evidence, I argue that we've just seen clear proof that too many people in this city know far too much about the case. Go Slow listens and acts as though she believes me, which I think she does.
"I'll overrule your motion for now, Mr. Rudd. Let's proceed and see what tomorrow brings."
Chapter 9. After court, partner drives me to the warehouse where Harry and Harry conduct their operations. I meet with Harry Gross, and we review Judith's latest petition. He'll prepare a response, one similar to the other 3 already on file, and I'll sign and file it tomorrow. Partner and I go to the basement, where Cliff and his team are already at work. From the first 4 rows of the pool, numbers 1 through 40, 9 people were quizzed privately during the afternoon session. I expect all 9 to be excused for cause, or for good reason. Each side has 4 challenges, 4 automatic hooks that can be used for no reason whatsoever. That's a total of 8. There is no limit on the number who can be excused for cause. The trick, the skill, the art, is reading the jurors and trying to determine which to challenge. I get only 4 strikes, same as the prosecution, and 1 mistake can be fatal. Not only do I decide whom to keep and whom to strike, but I also play chess with Mancini. Whom will he get rid of? Certainly the Hispanics. I do not expect an acquittal, so I'm angling for a hung jury. I have to find the one or two jurors who might show some sympathy. For hours, over bad carry-out sushi and bottles of green tea, we dissect each potential juror. Chapter 10. There are no phone calls in the middle of the night. Nothing from Arch Swanger nor Nate Spurio. Not a word from Moss Corgan. Evidently, my brilliant offer of a deal didn't get very far. As the sun rises, I'm at my computer responding to emails. I decide to send one to Judith. It reads, "Why can't you stop the war? You've lost so many battles, and you'll lose this one. The only thing you'll prove is how ridiculously stubborn you are. Think about Starcher, not yourself." The response will be predictably harsh and well-crafted. Partner drops me off in a strip mall out in the suburbs. The only store open is a bagel shop where smoking is illegally permitted. The owner is an old Greek who's dying of lung cancer. His nephew has rank at City Hall, and health inspectors don't bother the place. It features strong coffee, real yogurt, decent bagels, and a layer of rich blue cigarette smoke that's a throwback to the days not long ago when it was common to eat in a restaurant while inhaling the fumes and vapors of those close by. Nowadays, it's still hard to believe we tolerated that. Nate Spurio goes through 2 packs a day and loves this place. I take a deep breath out front, fill my lungs with clear air, walk inside, and see Nate at a table, coffee and newspaper in front of him, a fresh Salem screwed into the corner of his mouth. He waves at a chair and puts the paper away. "You want coffee?" he asks. "No, thanks. I've had enough." "How are things going?" "You mean life in general or the Zapata trial?" He grunts, tries to smile. "Since when do we talk about life in general?" "Good point. Nothing from Mancini. If he's in on the deal, he damn sure doesn't act like it. Still offering 15 years. They're working on him, but as you know, he's a prick who's going places. Right now he's on stage, and that means a lot to him." "So Roy Kemp is hammering away?" "You could say that. He's tightening every screw he can find. He's desperate. Can't say I blame him. And he hates you because he thinks you're withholding information." "Gee, I'm sorry. Tell him I hate him, too, because he kidnapped my kid, but nothing personal. If he'll get to the mayor, who can then get to Mancini, we might have us a deal." "It's in the works, okay? Things are moving." "Well, things need to move faster. We're picking a jury, and based on what I've seen and heard so far, my guy is in deep trouble." "That's what I hear." "Thanks. We'll probably start calling witnesses tomorrow, and there aren't many of them. This could be over by Friday. We need to cut the deal quickly. 5 years, county penal farm, early parole. Got it, Nate? Does everybody up the food chain understand the terms of the deal?" "Plain as day. It's not that complicated." "Then tell them to make it happen. My guy is about to get slammed by this jury." He pulls on the cigarette, fills his lungs, asks, "Are you around tonight?" "You think I'm leaving town?" "We should probably talk." "Sure, but now I gotta run. I have this trial today, and we're out here beating the bushes looking for some jurors to bribe." "I didn't hear a word, and I'm certainly not surprised. See you, Nate. A real pleasure. And you really should stop smoking. Just take care of yourself, okay? You got your own problems." Chapter 11. Go slow is late for court, which, on the one hand, is not that unusual because she is a judge and the party doesn't start until she arrives. On the other hand, though, this is a high watermark for her career, and you'd think she would arrive early and savor the moment. But I learned a long time ago not to waste time analyzing why judges do the things they do. Everyone has been waiting for at least an hour, with no word on what's causing the delay, when her courtroom deputy snaps to attention and calls us to order. Her Honor sweeps onto the bench as if she's already terribly burdened and tells everybody to sit down. No apology, no explanation. She launches into some introductory remarks, not a single word of which is even remotely original, and when she runs out of gas, she says, "Mr. Mancini, you may examine the panel for the state." Max is quickly on his feet, strutting along the mahogany railing that separates us from the spectators. With 92 jurors on one side and at least that many reporters and spectators on the other, the courtroom is again packed. They're even leaning against the rear wall. Max rarely has such an audience. He begins with a dreadful, sappy monologue about how honored he feels to just be in the courtroom representing the good people of our city. He feels a burden. He feels an honor. He feels an obligation. He feels a lot of things, and within a few minutes, I notice some of the jurors start to frown and look at him as if to say, "Is this guy serious?" After he's talked about himself for too long, I slowly stand, look at Her Honor, and say, "Judge, can we please get on with this?" She says, "Mr. Mancini, do you have some questions for the pool?" He replies,
"Of course, Your Honor. I didn't realize we were in such a hurry."
"Oh, there's no hurry. But I really don't want to waste time." This from a judge who was an hour late. Max begins with textbook questions about prior jury service and experiences with the criminal justice system and prejudices against the police and law enforcement. By and large, it's a waste of time because people rarely reveal their true feelings in such a setting. It does, however, give us plenty of time to study the jurors. Taddeo is taking pages of notes at my direction. I'm scribbling too, but I'm primarily watching body language. Cliff and his associate are on the pews across the aisle, watching everything. By now, I feel as though I've known these people, especially the first 40, for years. Max wants to know if any of them have ever been sued. A standard question, but not a great one. This is, after all, a criminal matter, not a civil one. Out of the 92, about 15 admit to being sued at some point in their past. I'll bet there are at least another 15 who are not admitting it. This is, after all, America. What honest citizen has never been sued? Max seems thrilled with this response, as if he's really found fertile dirt to dig in. He asks if their experiences within the court system would in any way affect their ability to deliberate in this case. "Nah, Max, everybody loves to get sued. And we do so without the slightest resentment toward the system." But he flails away with follow-up questions that go nowhere. For nothing but spite, I stand and say, "Your Honor, could you remind Mr. Mancini that this is a criminal case, not a civil one?"
"I know that," Max growls at me, and we exchange nasty looks. "I know what I'm doing."
"Move along, Mr. Mancini," Her Honor says. "And please keep your seat, Mr. Rudd." Max fights his anger and lets it pass. Changing gears, he wades into a sensitive matter. "Has anyone in your immediate family ever been convicted of a violent crime?" He apologizes for intruding into such a private matter, but he has no choice. Please forgive him. From the rear, juror number 81 slowly raises a hand. Mrs. Emma Huffinghouse, white, age 56, a freight company dispatcher. Her 27-year-old son is serving 12 years for a drug-fueled home invasion. As soon as Max sees her hand, he throws up his and pleads,
"I don't want the details, please. I know this is a very private matter and very hurtful, I'm sure. My question is this: was your experience with the criminal justice system satisfactory or unsatisfactory?"
"Seriously, Max? We're not filling out a survey for consumer satisfaction." Mrs. Huffinghouse stands slowly and says,
"I think my son was treated fairly by the system."
Max almost leaps over the bar to run hug her.
"Bless you, dear, bless you. What an endorsement for the forces of good. Too bad, Max, she's useless.
we won't get close to number 81. Juror number 47 raises his hand, stands, says his brother spent time in jail for aggravated assault, and unlike Mrs. Huffinghouse, he, Mark Wattberg, was not favorably impressed with the criminal process. But Max thanks him profusely anyway. Anybody else? No more hands. There are three others, and I suppose I know it, but Max doesn't. This confirms that my research is better than his. It also alerts me to the fact that these three are not altogether forthcoming. Max moves on as the morning drags. He steps into another delicate minefield, that of victimhood. Have any of you been the victim of a violent crime? You, your family members, close friends? Several hands go up, and Max does a nice job of eliciting information that's useful for a change. At noon, Her Honor, no doubt exhausted by 2 hours on the bench, and probably craving apple slices, announces a 90-minute break. Taddeo wants to stay in the courtroom for lunch. I make a pleasant request to his handler, who agrees, to our surprise. Partner hustles down the street to a deli and returns with sandwiches and chips. As we eat, we talk softly, keeping our voices low so the deputies and bailiffs cannot hear us. There is no one else in the courtroom. The gravity of the setting and surroundings has settled in, and Taddeo has lost some of his cockiness. He's absorbed the unforgiving stares from those who might be called upon to judge him. He no longer believes that they are his peers. Softly he says, "I get the feeling they don't like me." Such a perceptive young man. Chapter 12. Max finishes up around 3 and hands off to me. By now, I know more than enough about these people, and I'm ready for the selection. However, this is my first chance to speak directly to the pool, and it's an opportunity to lay the groundwork for what every lawyer hopes will become some level of trust. I watched their faces, and I know many of them found Max to be obsequious, even a bit goofy. I have an abundance of flaws and bad habits, but fawning is not part of my act. I don't thank them for being there. They were summoned. They have no choice. I don't pretend that we're doing something great, and they're a part of it. I don't brag on our judicial system. Instead, I talk in broad terms about the presumption of innocence. I urge them to ask themselves if they haven't already decided that my client is guilty of something, or else he wouldn't be here. Don't raise your hand. Just nod along with me if you think he's guilty. It's human nature. It's the way our society and culture work these days. There's a crime, an arrest, we see the suspect on television, and we're relieved that the police have caught their man. Presto, just like that. Crime solved. Guilty party in custody. These days, we never, never stop and say, "Wait, he's presumed to be innocent, and he's entitled to a fair trial." We rush to judgment. "Questions, Mr. Rudd?" Go Slow squawks into her microphone. I ignore her, point to Taddeo, and ask if they can truthfully say that at this moment they believe he's completely innocent. Of course, there is no response because no prospective juror will ever say she's made up her mind already. I move on to the burden of proof and discuss it until Max has had enough. He stands, arms open wide in complete frustration, and says, "Your Honor, he's not quizzing the panel. He's giving a law school lecture." "Agreed. Either ask your questions or sit down, Mr. Rudd," Go Slow says rather rudely. "Thank you," I reply, like the smartass I really am. I look at the first three rows and say, "Taddeo doesn't have to testify, doesn't have to call any witnesses." "Why?" "Because the burden of proving him guilty lies with the prosecution. Now, let's say he doesn't take the stand. Will that matter to you? Will you tend to think he's hiding something?" I use this all the time and rarely get a response. Today, though, juror number 17 wants to say something. Bobby Morris, age 36, white, a stonemason. He raises his hand and I nod at him. He says,
If I'm on the jury, then I think he should testify. I want to hear from the defendant.
Thank you, Mr. Morris, I reply warmly. Anybody else? With the ice broken, several others raise their hands, and I gently ask follow-up questions. As I had hoped, it becomes a discussion as more and more lose their inhibitions. I'm easy to talk to, a nice guy, a straight shooter with a sense of humor. When I'm finished, Her Honor informs us we will pick the jury before we go home and gives us 15 minutes to look at our notes. Chapter 13. The email from Judith reads,
Starcher is still upset. You are such a pathetic father. See you in court.
I'm tempted to fire something back, but why bother? Partner and I are driving away from the courthouse. It's dark, after 7 p.m., and it's been a hard day. We stop at a bar for a beer and a sandwich. 9 whites, 1 black, 1 Hispanic, 1 Vietnamese. With their names and faces so fresh, I have to talk about them. Partner, as always, listens dutifully with little comment. He has been in the courtroom for most of the past 2 days, and he likes the jury. I stop at 2 beers, though I really want several more. At 9 o'clock, Partner drops me off at an Arby's, and I fiddle with a soft drink for 15 minutes, waiting on Nate. He finally arrives, orders some onion rings, apologizes for being tardy.
"How's the trial going?" he asks.
"Got a jury late this afternoon. Opening statements in the morning. Then Mancini starts calling witnesses. Should go pretty fast. We got a deal?" He shovels in a large, crusty ring and chews fiercely while looking around. The place is empty. He swallows hard, says,
"Yep. Woody met with Mancini 2 hours ago and fired him. He replaced him with a flunky who was planning to move for a mistrial first thing in the morning. Mancini backed down and agreed to play along. He wants to meet with you and the judge at 8:30 tomorrow."
"The judge?"
"You got it. Seems Woody and Janet Fabineau have some mutual dealings, friends, whatever, and Woody insisted on putting her in the loop. She's good to go. She'll take the plea, approve the bargain, sentence your boy to 5 years at the penal farm, recommend early release. Just like you said, Rudd."
"Marvelous. And Lynx thugs?"
"That investigation is going nowhere. Forget about it."
He sucks on his straw and selects another onion ring.
"Now, Rudd, the fun part.
The last time I saw Swanger, the meeting was arranged through a prepaid cell phone he left behind for me in a pharmacy. I still have the phone. It's right outside in my van. I haven't used it since, so I don't know if it'll work. But if I get Swanger on the phone, I'll try to set up a meeting. I'll have to give him some cash."
"How much?"
$50,000, unmarked. He's not stupid."
$50,000?
"That's about a third of the reward money. I'm assuming he'll grab it because he's broke. Anything less might cause problems. Last year, you guys cashed in forfeited assets to the tune of $4 million, all retained by the department, pursuant to our brilliant state law. The money's there, Nate, and Roy Kemp would spend anything for the chance to see his daughter again."
"Okay, okay. I'll pass it along. That's all I can do."
I leave him with his onion rings and hurry to the van. As Partner drives away, I open the cheap phone and call the number. Nothing. An hour later, I call again. And again. Nothing. Chapter 14. Aided by exhaustion, the 2 beers, and a couple of whiskey sours, I fall asleep with the television on. I wake up in my recliner, still wearing a suit but no tie, socks but no shoes. My cell phone is ringing. Caller ID says, "Unknown." It's 1:40 a.m. I take a chance and say hello.
"You looking for me?" Swanger asks.
"Yes, as a matter of fact," I say, collapsing the footrest and bolting to my feet. Things are foggy and my brain needs blood.
"Where are you?"
"Dumb question. Any more stupidity and I'm hanging up."
"Look, Arch, there could be a deal in the works. That is, if you're telling the truth, which, frankly,
no one involved believes you're capable of.
I didn't call to get insulted.
Of course not. You called because you want money. I think I can broker a deal, act as the middleman, without a fee, of course. I'm not your lawyer, so I won't be sending you a bill.
Very funny. You're not my lawyer because you can't be trusted, Rudd.
Okay. Next time you snatch a girl, hire somebody else. You want the money or not, Arch? I really don't care. There is a brief pause as he thinks about how much he needs cash. Finally,
how much?
$25,000 now to tell us where the girl is. If they find her, then $25,000 more.
That's only a third of the reward money. You taking the rest?
Not a dime. As I said, I'm getting nothing. And that's the very reason I'm asking myself what the hell I'm doing in the middle of all this. Another pause as he contemplates a counteroffer.
I don't like the deal, Rudd. I'll never see the other 25.
And we'll never see the girl, I think, but don't say. Look, Arch, you're getting 25,000 bucks from the very people who would shoot you on sight. That's a lot more than you made last year with honest work.
I don't believe in honest work. Neither do you. That's why you're a lawyer.
Ha ha, you're clever. You want a deal, Swanger? If not, I'm butting out. I got more important things on my mind these days.
$50,000, Rudd. Cash.
$50,000, and I'll tell you and you alone where the girl is right now.
If this is a setup, or if I smell a cop anywhere around, I'll bolt, make a call, and the girl will be gone for good. Understand?
I got it. I'm not sure about the money, but all I can do is pass this along to my contact.
Work fast, Rudd. My patience is running thin.
Oh, you'll find the time if the money's on the table. Who are you kidding, Swanger? The line goes dead. So much for a good night's sleep. Chapter 15. 3 hours later, I stop at an all-night convenience store and buy a bottle of water. Outside, I'm approached by a cop in plain clothes who grunts, "You Rudd?" Since I am, he hands me a brown paper grocery bag with a cigar box inside.
$50,000, he says. All in hundreds.
That'll do, I say. What am I supposed to say?
Thanks.
I leave the city alone. During my last conversation with Swanger, about an hour ago, he instructed me to ditch my thug and do the driving myself. He also told me to forget the fancy new van and drive something else. I explained that, at the moment, I had nothing else and didn't have time to run get a rental. The van will have to do. I try not to dwell on the fact that this guy is watching me. He knew the moment partner and I began buzzing around in a U-Haul van. Now he knows I have new wheels. It's astonishing that he's in the city enough to know these things, yet still undiscovered by the police. I suspect he'll finally disappear when he gets the money, which will not be a bad thing. As instructed, I call him as I leave the city on the southern bypass of the interstate. His directions are precise.
Go 16 miles south to exit 184. Take Route 63 east to the town of Jobs.
As I drive, I remind myself that I have this trial that's supposed to kick off in just a few hours. Or is it? If Judge Fabineau is really in the loop, what does that mean for the rest of the day? I have no idea how much surveillance is tracking me right now, but I'm sure it is substantial. I didn't ask questions, didn't have time to, but I know Roy Kemp and his team have called in all the bloodhounds. There are two mics in my van and a tracking device inside the rear bumper. I've allowed them to listen to my cell phone, but just for the next few hours. I'll bet they already have people closing in on the town of Jobs. A helicopter or two in the air above me would not be a surprise. I'm not frightened. Swanger has no reason to harm me, but my nerves are jumping nonetheless. The money is unmarked and cannot be traced. The police don't care if they get it back. They just want the girl. They're also assuming Swanger is smart enough to spot anything fishy. Jobs is a small town of 3,000. When I pass a Shell station on the edge of town, I call Swanger as instructed. He says,
"Stay on the line. Turn left just past the car wash.
I turn left onto a dark, paved street with a few old houses on both sides. He says,
"You swear you got 50 grand, Rudd?"
"I do."
"Take a right and go over the railroad tracks."
I do as I'm told, and he says,
"Now turn right onto that first street. It has no name. Stop at the first stop sign and wait."
When I stop, a figure suddenly appears from the darkness and yanks the passenger door handle. I press the button to unlock it, and Swanger jumps inside. He points left, says,
"Go that way and take your time. We're headed back to the interstate."
"Great to see you again, Arch." He's wearing a black do-rag that covers his eyebrows and ears. Everything else is black, too, from the bandana around his neck to his combat boots. I almost ask him where he parked, but why bother?
"Where's the money?" he demands.
I nod over my shoulder, and he grabs the bag. He opens the cigar box, and with a small keychain light, counts the money. He looks up, says,
"Take a right,"
then keeps counting. As we are leaving the town, he takes a deep, satisfied breath and offers me a goofy grin.
"All here," he says.
"You doubt me?"
"Damned right I doubt you, Rudd."
He points to the Shell station and says,
"You want a beer?"
"No, I don't normally drink beer at 5:30 in the morning."
"It's the best time. Pull in."
He goes inside without the money. He takes his time, selects a bag of chips to go with his six-pack, and strolls back to the van as if he has no concerns whatsoever. When we're moving again, he rips off a can and pops the top. He slurps it and opens the chips.
"Where are we going, Arch?"
I ask, with no small amount of irritation.
"Get on the interstate and head south. This van still smells new, you know that, Rudd? I think I like the old one better."
He crunches a mouthful of chips and washes it all down with a gulp of beer. "Too bad. Don't spill any crumbs, okay? Partner gets really pissed off if he finds crumbs in the van."
"That your thug?"
"You know who it is." We're on Route 63, still dark and deserted. No sign of sunrise. I keep glancing around, thinking I'll see some of the surveillance, but of course they're too good for that. They're back there, or up there, or waiting at the interstate. Then again, what do I know about such things? I'm a lawyer. He pulls a small phone out of his shirt pocket and holds it up for me to see. He says,
"Know one thing, Rudd. If I see a cop, smell a cop, or hear a cop, all I do is push this button on this phone, and somewhere, far away, bad things happen. You understand?"
"Got it. Now where, Arch?" "That's the first thing. Where, when, how? You have the money, now you owe us the story. Where is the girl, and how do we get her?" He drains the first can, smacks his lips, reloads another mouthful of chips, and for a few miles it seems as though he has gone mute. Then he opens another beer. At the intersection, he says,
"Go south."
Traffic in the northbound lane is busy as the early commuters head for the city. The southbound, though, is practically deserted. I look at him and want to slap the smirk off his face.
"Arch?"
He takes another drink and sits taller.
"They've taken the girls from Chicago to Atlanta. They move around a lot, every 4 or 5 months. They'll work a town pretty hard, but then after a while, people start talking. The cops start sniffing around, and so they disappear, set up shop somewhere else. It's hard to keep secrets when you're offering pretty young women at good prices."
"If you say so. Is Juliana Kemp still alive?"
"Oh, yes. Very much so. She's quite active. Not like she has a choice."
"And she's in Atlanta?"
"The Atlanta area."
"It's a big city, Arch, and we don't have time to play games. If you have an address, then give it to me. That's the deal." He takes a deep breath and another long drink.
"They're in a big strip mall where there's traffic. Lots of cars and people come and go. Atlas Physical Therapy is the name of the company, but it's nothing but an upper-end brothel. No number in the phone book. Therapists on call. Appointments only, no walk-ins. Every customer has to be referred by another customer, and they, the head therapists, know who they're dealing with.
So if you're a customer, you park in the lot, maybe step into the Baskin-Robbins for an ice cream, stroll along the sidewalk, then duck into Atlas. A guy wearing a white lab coat says hello and acts real nice, but under the coat is a loaded piece. He pretends to be a therapist, and he does, in fact, know a lot about broken bones. He takes your money, say $300 cash, and leads you back to some rooms. He points to one, you walk in, and there's a small bed and a girl who's young and pretty and almost naked. You get 20 minutes with her. You leave through another door and no one knows you've had your therapy. The girls work all afternoon. They get the mornings off because they're up late. Then they load them up and take them to the strip clubs where they dance and do their routines. At midnight, they take them home to a fairly nice apartment complex where they're locked down for the night. Who is they? They are the traffickers, some extremely nasty guys. A gang, a ring, a cartel, a disciplined band of criminals, most with ties to Eastern Europe, but some local boys as well. They abuse the girls, keep them terrified and confused and hooked on heroin. Most people in this country don't believe there's sex trafficking in their cities, but it's there. It's everywhere. They, the traffickers, prey on runaways, homeless kids, girls from bad families looking for escape. It's a sick business, Rudd. Really sick. I start to rebuke him and curse him, remind him of his rather important role in a business he seems to detest, but it would serve no purpose. Instead, I go along with him. How many girls now?
It's hard to say. They split them up, move them around. A few have disappeared for good.
I don't really want to pursue this. Only a creep involved in the business would know so much about it. He points and says,
Turn around at this exit and go back north.
Where are we going, Arch?
I'll show you. Just hang on.
Okay. Now about that address.
Here's what I would do if I were the cops, he says with a sudden voice of authority. I'd watch the place, Atlas, and I'd nab a John when he comes out, fresh from therapy. He's probably a local insurance agent who's not getting any at home, and he's taken a shine to one of the girls. You can actually ask for your favorite, but the request is non-binding. They got their rules. Or maybe he's a local ambulance chaser like you, Rudd, just another sleazy lawyer who's hitting on everything but not scoring much, and for $300, he gets his therapy.
Anyway,
they grab the guy, scare the living shit out of him, and within minutes, he's singing like a choir boy. He tells them everything, especially the layout of the interior. They make him cry, then let him go. They, the cops, already have a warrant. They surround the place with one of those SWAT squads, and it goes down beautifully. The girls are rescued. The traffickers are caught red-handed, and if the cops do it right, they can flip one of them instantly. If he sings, he'll implicate the entire ring. There could be hundreds of girls and dozens of goons. Could be huge, Rudd. All because of you and me.
Yeah, we're a real team swanger. I take the exit ramp, cross over the interstate, and re-enter it headed north. All the eyes watching my van must be wondering what the hell. My passenger pops another top, his third. The chips are gone, and I'm sure there are crumbs left behind. I push it to 70 miles an hour and say, The address, Arch.
It's in the suburb of Vista View, about 10 miles due west of downtown Atlanta. The strip mall is called West Ivy. Atlas Physical Therapy is next door to Sunny Boy Cleaners. The girls will get there around 1 p.m.
And Juliana Kemp is one of them?
I've already answered that, Rudd. You think I'd tell you all this if she wasn't there? But the cops better go in quick. These people can roll up and move in a matter of minutes.
I have what I want, so I go quiet. For some reason I say, Can I have a beer? For a second he looks irritated, as if he needs all six himself. But then he smiles and hands one over. Chapter 16 A few miles down the road, and after a long, pleasant stretch of silence, Swanger nods and says,
There it is, Dr. Wu and his billboard for vasectomy reversals. Brings back memories, right, Rudd?
I spent a long night there watching them dig. Why'd you do that, Arch?
Why do I do anything, Rudd? Why did I grab that girl and mistreat her and sell her?
She's not the first, you know. I really don't care at this point. I just hope she's the last. He shakes his head and says with some sadness,
No way. Pull over here on the shoulder.
I hit the brakes and the van rolls to a stop under the bright lights from Dr. Wu. Swanger grabs the sack full of money, leaves the beer behind, and yanks the door handle. He says,
Tell those dumbass cops they'll never find me.
He jumps out, slams the door, and bounces down the shoulder into some tall grass, over a fence, and under the billboard. The last image is Swanger ducking low between the thick posts, scrambling fast, and making tracks, then disappearing into the tall corn. To be safe, I drive half a mile down the interstate, pull off again, and call the cops. They've listened to every word spoken in the van for the past hour, so there's little for me to say. I do stress that it would be a mistake to try and corner Swanger until the raid takes place in Atlanta. They seem to agree. I see no activity in and around the cornfield by the billboard. As I'm driving back to the city, my cell phone buzzes. Max Mancini. I say, Good morning.
I just spoke with Judge Fabineau. Seems as if she's been stricken with severe food poisoning. No court today.
Gee, that's awful.
I knew you'd be disappointed. Get some sleep and we'll talk later.
Okay. Am I supposed to check in with you?
Yes.
And Rudd?
Nice work. We'll see.
I pick up partner at his apartment, and we settle in for a long breakfast at a waffle place. I recount the adventures of the past 7 hours, and he, typically, listens without a word. I need to lie down and try to sleep, but I'm too wired. I try to kill time around the courthouse, but I'm so preoccupied with the raid in Atlanta, I can think of nothing else. Normally, I would be frantically preparing for Tadeo's trial, but now I doubt it will take place. I've kept my end of the bargain, and regardless of what happens to Gillianna Kemp, we should have a deal. A nice little plea bargain that will allow my client to fight again, and soon. But I trust no one I'm dealing with at the moment. If the raid produces nothing, it would not be a surprise if the mayor, Max Mancini, Moss Corgan, Go Slow Fabineau, and the police brass all get together in a room and decide, Screw Rudd and his client. Let's go to trial. Chapter 17. By 2 p.m. Eastern Time, the parking lot of the West Ivy Shopping Center is crawling with federal agents, all dressed in a wide variety of casual garb and driving nondescript vehicles. Those with more substantial weapons are hiding in unmarked vans. The unlucky John is a 41-year-old car salesman named Ben Brown. Husband, father of four, nice home not far away. After therapy, he leaves Atlas through an unmarked door, makes it to his vehicle, a demo, and is allowed to drive half a mile before being pulled over by a local cop. Ben's first words are to the effect that he damned well wasn't speeding, but when a black SUV wheels to a stop in front of him, he suspects deeper trouble. He is introduced to two FBI agents and led to the rear seat of their vehicle. He is placed under arrest for soliciting prostitution and told he will probably be indicted for all manner of federal offenses at a later date. Atlas, he is informed, is part of an interstate sex ring, thus the federal charges. Ben's life flashes before his eyes, and he's barely able to hold back tears. He tells the agents he has a wife and four kids. They are not sympathetic. He's facing years in jail. The agents, however, are willing to deal. If he tells them everything, they will allow him to hop in his car and drive away, a free man. On the one hand, something tells Ben to clam up and demand an attorney. On the other, he wants to trust them and save his skin. He starts talking. This is his fourth or fifth visit to Atlas. He usually had a different girl. That's what he likes about the place, the variety. $300 a pop. No paperwork, of course not.
He was recommended by a friend at the car dealership. Everything is kept very quiet. Yes, he has vouched for two other buddies. Recommendations are required. Security seems tight. Confidentiality ensured. Inside, there is a small reception area where he always meets the same man, Travis, who wears a white lab coat, tries to look the part. Through a door, there are 6 to 8 rooms, all about the same. Small bed, small chair, naked girl. Things go quick. It's sort of like a drive-through sex shop, in and out, unlike one time in Vegas where the girl hung around and they ate chocolates and drank champagne. No smiles from the FBI. Any other men there? Yes, maybe. Seems like there was one other guy one time. Everything's real clean and efficient, except the walls are pretty thin, and it's not unusual to hear some rather graphic sounds from other therapy sessions. The girls? Well, of course, there is a Tiffany and a Brittany and an Amber, but who knows what the real names are. Ben is told to go and sin no more. He speeds away, eager to run tell his buddies to stay away from Atlas. The raid happens moments later. With all doors blocked by heavily armed agents, there is no time to even think about resistance or escape. 3 men are handcuffed and hauled away. 6 girls, including Juliana Kemp, are rescued and taken into protective custody. Just before 3 p.m., she calls her parents, sobbing hysterically. She had been abducted 13 months earlier, and she had given birth in captivity. She has no idea what happened to her baby. Under enormous pressure, one of the 3 men, an American, takes the bait and starts singing. Names pour forth, then addresses, then everything else he can think of. As the hours pass, the web grows rapidly. FBI offices in a dozen cities put everything else on hold. One of Mayor Woody's banker buddies has a corporate jet, and the guy is eager to send it. By 7 p.m., on a day when she would normally be ending another nightmare at Atlas and preparing for a night of stripping and table dancing, Juliana Kemp is suddenly flying home. A flight attendant takes care of her and will later say she cried all the way. Chapter 18. Once again, Arch Swanger slips through the net. There is no sign of him after he disappears into the cornfield. The police think they could have caught him then and there, but since they were ordered to wait until after the raid, they somehow lost him. It's apparent that he has an accomplice. From the point where I picked him up at the stop sign in Job's, it's about 40 miles to Dr. Wu's sign beside the interstate. Someone had to be driving a getaway car. I doubt I've heard the last of him. Chapter 19. After dark, partner and I drive to the jail to deliver the great news to Tadeo. He is being offered the deal of all deals, a light sentence, an easier prison, a guarantee of early parole for good behavior. With some luck, he'll be back in the ring in 2 years, his career bolstered by the ex-con aura and that famous YouTube video. I have to admit I'm getting excited thinking about his comeback. With great satisfaction, I lay it all on the table, or most of it. I spare him the details of the Swanger adventure, and instead place emphasis on my prowess as a negotiator and much-feared trial lawyer. Tadeo is not impressed. He says no.
No!
I attempt to explain that he cannot simply say no. He's facing a decade or more in a tough prison, and now I'm delivering a deal so fantastic that the presiding judge can't believe it. Wake up, man! No. I am stunned, incredulous. He sits with his arms crossed over his chest, such an arrogant little punk, and says no over and over. No deal. He will not plead guilty under any circumstances. He has seen his jurors, and after a few doubts, he is once again confident they will not convict him. He will insist on taking the stand and telling his side of the story. He is cocky, hard-headed, and irritated by my desire to see him plead guilty. I keep my cool and go back to the basics. The charges,
The evidence, the video, the shakiness of our expert testimony, the composition of the jury, the bloodbath that awaits him on cross-examination, the likelihood of 10 or more years in prison, everything. Nothing registers. He's an innocent man who sort of accidentally killed a referee with nothing but his hands, and he can explain it all to the jury. He'll walk out a free man, and when he does, well, then it'll be payback time. He'll find a new manager and a new lawyer. He accuses me of being disloyal. This makes me angry, and I tell him he's being stupid. I ask him whom he's listening to back there in the cell block. Things go from bad to worse, and after an hour, I storm out of the room. I thought I might sleep tonight, but it looks like I'll go through the usual pre-trial insomnia. Chapter 20. At 5 on Thursday morning, I'm drinking strong coffee and reading the Chronicle online. It's all about the rescue of Gillianna Kemp. The largest photo on page 1 is just what I envisioned. Mayor Woody at the podium in all his glory, with Roy Kemp beside him, a wall of blue behind them. Gillianna is not in the photo, though there is a slightly smaller one of her getting off the jet at the airport. Baseball cap, big sunglasses, collar turned up. You can't tell much, but she looks reasonably good. She is resting at home with her family and friends, it says. The sex trafficking story runs for pages, and the FBI operation is obviously still in progress. Arrests are being made across the country. So far, about 25 girls have been rescued. There was a shooting in Denver, but no serious injuries. Thankfully, there's not a word about Gillianna's heroin addiction, or about the lost baby. One nightmare is over. Others continue. I suppose I should take some measure of quiet satisfaction in having had a hand in this, but I don't. I bartered information to benefit a client. That's all. Now that client has gone stupid, and I get nothing out of the deal. I wait until 7 a.m. to send a text message to both Max Mancini and Judge Fabineau. It reads, "After extensive discussion, my client refuses to accept the plea agreement now being offered by the prosecution. I have strongly advised him to accept it, to no avail. It appears as though the trial must go on, pending the health of the judge. Sorry. S.R. Mancini responds, "Let's tee it up. See you soon." He, of course, is thrilled because he's back on center stage. Evidently, Judge Fabineau has made a quick recovery. She texts, "Okay, the show must go on. We'll meet in chambers at 8:30. I'll inform my bailiff." Chapter 21. The players assemble in the courtroom as if nothing happened yesterday, or at least nothing that would in any way affect the trial. A few of us know, me, the prosecutor, the judge, partner, but no one else knows, nor should they. I whisper to Taddeo. He has not changed his mind. He can win this trial. We retire to the judge's chambers for our early morning update. To cover my ass, I inform her and Max that I want to put my client on the record, so there will be no doubt in the years to come about his refusal to take a plea. A bailiff brings him in, no cuffs, no restraints. He's smiling and being very polite. He's put under oath and says he has a clear mind and knows what's going on. Fabineau asks Mancini to recite the terms of the plea agreement. 5 years for a guilty plea to manslaughter. Her Honor says that she cannot promise any particular prison facility, but is of the opinion that Mr. Zapata would do quite well just down the road at the county penal farm. Only 6 miles away. His mother can visit frequently. Furthermore, she does not control parole, but as the sentencing judge, she has the authority to recommend an early release. Does he understand all of this? He says he does, and goes on to say that he ain't pleading guilty to anything. I state that I have advised him to take the deal. He says, yes, he understands my advice, but he's not taking it. We go off the record, and the court reporter shuts down. Judge Fabineau folds her fingers together like a veteran kindergarten teacher
and in a painfully deliberate manner tells Taddeo that she has never seen such a good deal for any defendant charged with the death of another person. In other words, boy, you're a fool to refuse this deal. He doesn't budge. Next, Max explains that he, as a career prosecutor, has never offered a plea deal as lenient as this one. It's extraordinary, really. 18 months or so in the pen, full access to the weight room, and there are excellent facilities at the penal farm, and you'll be back in the cage before you know it. Taddeo just shakes his head. Chapter 22. The jurors file in and glance around expectantly, nervously. There is an air of excitement in the courtroom as this drama is about to unfold, but I feel nothing but the usual thick knot in my stomach. The first day is always the hardest. As the hours pass, we'll settle into a routine and the butterflies will slowly dissipate. At the moment, though, I'd like to go vomit. An old trial lawyer once told me that if the day came when I walked into a courtroom and faced a jury without fear, then it was time to quit. Max rises purposefully and walks to a spot in front of the jury box. He offers his standard welcoming smile and says good morning. Sorry about the delay yesterday. Again, his name is Max Mancini, chief prosecutor for the city. This is a grave matter because it involves the loss of life. Sean King was a fine man with a loving family, a hard-working guy trying to earn a few bucks on the side as a referee. There is no dispute as to the cause of death or who killed him.